I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Law!
Rugby Weekly.
Then the first pass, and
hello everybody and welcome to your Monday episode of Rugby Weekly Extra. Hope you had a fantastic weekend wherever you were. And if you were in Ireland, I hope you enjoyed the sun. It's an absolute game changer. And we're going to look back over all of the rugby that was played beneath it in the URC, where there were three victories for the provinces. A couple of those victories may not have been the ones that you would have expected, actually, when making predictions on Friday. The Ireland women had a tough day at Twickenham. We'll spin back around to that towards the end of the show. There were AIL semi-finals as well, and the final will be played at the Aviva Stadium, both men's and women's, actually, next weekend. So it was an unbelievably busy one. Joining us to discuss it all is Murray Kinsella, firstly. And before I ask you how you're doing, Murray, I must say congratulations to the Waterford Hurlers for a fine victory over my boys yesterday. How did your weekend go?
A good weekend all round on the sporting front. And isn't summer rugby just a joy? As you mentioned there, several big occasions around the country here in Ireland with the AIL, but also away, and it's just so fun to watch and so enjoyable to be there if you're there and have the sun on your skin. And yeah, summer rugby, more of it would be great, and better weather in Ireland would be great on a regular basis.
Bernard Jackman, I know you're a busy man as well. Firstly, how was your weekend, and then we'll get into the rest of it.
Yeah, good. Well, if we go back to Thursday, Friday, I was in Versailles on a recce mission for the Paris Games with the Olympic Federation of Ireland and our chef to keep. So really good to get to see the progress they're making in terms of building the showgrounds, across country track, and obviously logistics, hotels and shuttles and all that stuff. So that was great. And then did our Bulls against Munster for RT on Saturday, which was a cracking match, cracking game. So yeah, all good, and a day off yesterday. So feel great. Feel great.
Rare day off.
Rare also that you would see a statement from a club so gushing towards somebody who's departing, Bertrand. You've decided to step down from your role at Bective. They were clearly very appreciative of all your efforts there. What was behind that decision? Just time?
Time. Look, I wish I could keep doing it. I really, really enjoyed it. But to be honest, even this year, I couldn't do it justice. Like, just too many. Once I took on this job, well, first of all, media wise, it's obviously always a balancing act, because you know Saturdays is often when there's a televised game, and I often, you know, was leaving Donnybrook 4:10 to get to Cork or Limerick, and it's always chasing your tail a little bit. But then there was the World Cup, obviously, where I missed some games, and I think once I took this job with Horsesport Ireland, thought I could do both, but it's more time consuming than I probably allowed for, and there's fewer things happening business wise that I just can't commit to it. And they need, like, the lads are committed, and they need a coach who can actually be there at least 95% of the time, I would say, and I would have struggled to that next year. I really enjoyed it. Unfortunately, I won't be coaching anyone, I will miss that, but I suppose I got to look at other things.
Yeah. While we're on the topic of domestic rugby, Murray, you had Terenure reaching back-to-back AIL Division 1A finals, and Corcon back in their first finals since 2019. After two thrilling semi-finals as well, they were streamed live. It feels as though the AIL is just on the up. I know we've pointed towards it a couple of times, but these games, the standard of them, were probably further indicative of that. The grassroots game, if that's what you want to call it, AIL in general, it's in a pretty good place now, isn't it?
It's thriving, really, and it's so heartening to see. And all the glimpses of the rugby I caught, once again, as always, were of a really high quality. And I remember chatting earlier this season to Ger Slattery in Young Munster, and he said anyone who actually comes down, say for the first time, they're usually taken aback by just how good the rugby is. It's so close to professional rugby, just in terms of how they play and how they operate, all the same systems, all the same philosophies, really, but also the quality of the players, guys who maybe just missed out here or there, or club legends who've stuck at it and are real battling players, and young prospects who are trying to make it as well. So, yeah, it was brilliant to have the excellent weather and have people out in force, like hearing about some of the crowds, just off the charts. Terenure obviously have managed to create something really special with their club, but you're talking thousands of people through the gate there, which is amazing for them on a financial basis, obviously, because that drives the club, but also just for the sense of occasion. Anyone who was there just blown away by that, and a really thrilling game, and reports of that around the country. So it is brilliant to see. And yeah, I think everyone listening to this podcast, most people will be advocates of the AIL and know all about it. But if you're not yet, it's always worth getting out to your local club. It's something special to have that bond with your community, but also the quality of product now is just outstanding, and you're going to see some future stars and some guys who've just maybe missed the boat a little bit but are still operating at a high class level. So wonderful for the AIL to have beautiful weather in which to, I suppose, celebrate what it is, a brilliant league with brilliant rugby.
That was probably one of the most striking aspects of it, Birch, just looking at some of the highlights. I had a stream on of the Con game I was working on Saturday, and had I not been, I would have popped up to Temple Hill. I'm not far from there, and I used to play for Con when I was a child anyway. But like, it was just the number of people packed in there, and like, you see, say, the reaction to Aaron Egan's heroics there at the end for Terenure against Lansdowne. It's like, I don't know, it seemed like a proper atmosphere as well. It's kind of not so much just a day out. It's like properly passionate, engaged fans, like roaring their teams on. And it adds to the spectacle, adds to the sense of occasion, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think the scenes in Terenure, obviously it's a Dublin derby, and Terenure get great crowds all the time. But just, they put a photograph up of the lane that you walk in, just being like absolutely chock-a-blocked, and then seeing some of the footage, what all those clubs have done this year, in terms around team announcements and things, has been really creative. I'm sure if you're playing in that environment, it makes you feel a little bit special, more special than potentially happened in the past. And then obviously getting good crowds there is great, and I actually think that's the way to keep players in the game, because there has been a big drop off, and non players who don't get the academy spot they want historically had tended, some of them had tended to drop out of the game, or they get an academy and not get a full contract, drop out of the game, or get released early, drop out of the game. Whereas I think vibrant club game, you know, you see some of the names, you know, the Jordan Cotlins, the Harrison Brewers in Terenure, for example. All clubs have a smattering of them at the top level who have been near or in the pro game and are still playing. Tony Ryan, Matt Darcy retired from Clontarf this weekend. You know, Tony Ryan was in Leinster for a while. Matt Darcy obviously had a season at Munster. So, but then went on to have 6, 7, 8 years more playing in the league. So, I think it's brilliant. And also, like at junior level, the Towns Cup, Sean O'Brien won his first Towns Cup as a player yesterday when Tullow beat Ashburn in front of a huge crowd. And like, he grew up with his uncles and his father, you know, and his family being passionate about Towns Cup. And one of the reasons he went back playing was to win a Towns Cup, and he fulfilled that. And that shows you, I mean, he's won probably everything you can want to win in the game, and played for the British and Irish Lions, and yet playing for his home club, you know, at the end meant something to him. And I think it's phenomenal. It's great to see because it was dying on its feet a little bit, the club game, for a while, but there's really positive signs now.
The other good thing about the weekend, Gav, is that clubs from all four corners of the island had big results, and some of those clubs maybe further down the chain, and we want them driving up in and being competitive in 1A. But you look at Cork Con versus Terenure, it's going to be a brilliant final. They both play really excellent high quality rugby. But looking at the other results, obviously Gary Owen have a big win in Old Wesley. Old Belvedere go down to Shannon and have a massive win, which is huge on the road. But you've got Queen's University beating Banbridge, which is great for Ulster rugby. I think Corinthians and Galwegians both won. And yeah, it's in 2A and 2B, and they'll be hoping they can drive up into the top echelons of the AIL in the next couple of years. But I think good to see that there's success across the board and good stories across the board. And that's what the AIL is as well. It's everyone. And if you can, I think there's a few examples in recent years where it just shows if you can get a good project with players really buying in, both on and off the pitch, I would say, which is something that Terenure have done well. Their players really seem to just be part of the fabric of the club. You know, you can have a really great story and journey and have a, you know, a lifetime highlight in rugby. So I love seeing those kind of stories, and I love seeing clubs who have got themselves organised and got a really good core group of players to drive things on, and it's all over the country. It's not just limited to Dublin or to Leinster at all.
Proper All-Ireland final day next Sunday. You've got UL Bowes against Railway Union in the women's final. That kicks off at 1:45. And then you've got Conn against Terenure in the men's Division 1A final. Both at the Aviva Stadium, both live on TG Carr if you can't make it to the Aviva as well. So it's going to be a proper weekend. And Birch, to follow up upon what was a busy weekend for yourself, you mentioned all of these media gigs. How are you finding being a columnist, out of interest?
I enjoy it.
Taking some heat.
Taking some heat yesterday. But look, if you're not, I suppose you're not taking heat, you're probably just, just putting out boring stuff, which I do most weeks. So, I think it's interesting. Like, I only write once a week for the Sunday Independent. And probably 90% of the time, it is opinion pieces. You know, the odd big Six Nations game, it'll be a report on the game, but a report mixed with opinion. And that's actually, I find that easier, even though there's time constraint, because you watch a match and you react to it, whereas the opinion piece, you probably have a little bit more time to think. I think I made a mess of it. It was a really long article, and I probably covered too much, and end up probably confusing people, which I'm a bit frustrated with. But I think the reaction to it, it's been interesting. Look, I don't really, I'm very lucky in that I meet a lot of rugby fans face to face, you know, whether that's at the Barack Obama Plaza before and after a match in Toma Park, you know, when you're filling up a petrol or getting a coffee and you see them in the red jerseys and they speak to you, whether it's in the car park in Limerick IT when you're coming out. So you walk out of games, or you walk into games with Munster fans and Connacht fans and Ulster fans, and they chat to you, and you kind of get a feel for where they're at. I would have sensed there was a big frustration with Munster fans around how they've dropped off the top level where they were, and that they want to get back there. But it seems as if there's no issue in Munster rugby. If you were to believe the online reaction to my column that Munster are the greatest team slash band, and Leinster should be ridiculed for losing to the Lions, because, and Leinster are the ones in trouble. So that's the difference. Like, the online reaction and the face-to-face reaction are very different. But it's all really good. But like, it's very difficult to be reasonable with people who I would say are unreasonable. So I'll give you an example. So I was told, what the online reaction is that Munster, the only reason Munster are struggling is because of bias by Andy Farrell. That's why I'm getting a lot of direct messages about that. Andy Farrell is picking Leinster players above Munster players, and that's where the issue is. And I had never thought of that, to be honest. That was never in my, and maybe I'm told, maybe it's a blind spot for me, but I genuinely, when I look at those central contracts, I don't really see a big issue with them. I genuinely think they are good players, you know what I mean? And while I don't doubt that the Irish contracted players are a million miles better than some of the other players in provincial rugby, that's not the case. I don't think that they're there because Farrell has a bias towards Leinster. And I'll give you an example. John Hodnett, and this is Twitter or whatever, so again, but I'll just give you an example. So John Hodnett is an amazing player. I think he's brilliant, right? But he's in a very competitive area in the Irish team. And like, Josh hasn't done a huge amount wrong, you know. So realistically, Josh has to lose form. And Josh got dropped last week for La Rochelle game because Leinster went for Horses for Courses selection. But the argument was that Will Connors got picked ahead of John Hodnett for Ireland. And I was like, well, not really. Like, Will Connors hasn't really been in the Irish team since John Hodnett kind of burst on the scene, I would have thought. Maybe I was wrong. And the argument, I said, oh, not really. And he said, well, that John Hodnett played Will Connors off the park in the semi-final in the URC last year. Again, it's not relevant because Will Connors hasn't got picked. But just when I looked at it, Will Connors only played for 1 minute. You know what I mean? He got injured. He was injured. And then when I said he only played for a minute, yeah, he couldn't live with him. You know, and you're just going, well, okay, I can't. I haven't seen a match where a player basically puts up the white flag after a minute because the opposition is too good. So that was me done. I'm not engaging anymore with said individual. But my point was that I don't think this is Leinster's fault to a certain extent. what I want is four strong provinces and a strong Ireland, right? And at the moment, I think we've got, and again, look at, maybe I was harsh, Munster are the URC champions. But when I think of Munster, I think of them as a top four or five team in Europe in the Champions Cup. And, you know, I looked up the rankings. They're 18th in Europe in the rankings. They have dropped off. Like, you don't assume they're going to be semi-finalists, finalists in Europe every year. And I know Leinster haven't been winning European trophies, but they've been pretty close to it. You know, they are, like, I think, whether if you're Ron Nogara, you're Ugo Mulla, you're Mark McCall, when you look down at the start of the season, you see Leinster as the team you don't want to play in Europe. Munster, based on this year, and Bayonne, you know, Northampton, over the last couple of years, they're not the force they were in Europe, despite that URC. And that's where I see Munster. And I want Ulster to be, and Ulster, it's a long time since they won the European Cup, but they were a team that no one wanted to play in Europe, and that's dropped off. So, and Connacht, obviously, you know, they've always been the poor relation, but I don't see any reason why we shouldn't aspire to have them at the same level. So, but I don't think it's Leinster's fault. I don't think it's Leinster's fault. So that's kind of was what I wanted to get across. And I think if you can understand where the fault lies to a certain extent, you can start to actually have a solution. Start thinking about a solution. I think that's the opportunity for David Humphreys to come in here now. Like, there's apparently going to be a review of the central contracting model. And what that looks like, I'm not sure. I am in favour, to be honest, personally, of moving players, you know, to other provinces. I would love to see a position where the other provinces could come in and try and talent ID the best young players. Or sorry, not come into Leinster, but to talent ID the best young players across the country at 18 and offer them spots in their academy. That's how I see changing. Okay, they're not going to be homegrown Munster, Connacht, Ulster players as such. They haven't grown up in West Cork or Waterford or whatever. Just use Munster, for example. But if they've been in your academy since they're 18, you know, they are effectively homegrown for me. And it gives them a chance to get, you know, the Joe McCarthy's of this world, or who's one of the latest to step up. And it's something to do with central contracts. It's actually been allowing a free market. And then obviously that they have the talent or and pathways and alignment between their senior coaches and their academy coaches to bring those players to the level that they potentially have. So look, it's not a big thing. But I do think from an Irish rugby point of view, and we've said it here and I've said it for the last couple of years, I do see the other three getting weaker compared to the opposition, and I don't think that's a great thing.
It's interesting you raise that point about schools players, Birch, because I got quite a few emails again, Gav, based on our chat on Friday. I think people are really interested in this. How do you even describe it? Issue, system. Yeah. It's the whole system we're talking about here. It's so complex. But Morgan Downey was on saying his feeling was that there is nothing to stop the other provinces scouting the Leinster school system. But as far as I understand, I think you might have the same understanding, Birch. Leinster get their pick first to go into the academy.
Yes.
That's what we understand. So Leinster get first choice, essentially. So the other provinces kind of have to wait and see who doesn't get into the Munster academy. So just to answer Morgan's query on that, he's kind of taken issue with this chat around the school system and saying the topic doesn't really hold as much water because the Leinster Academy is exactly the same as the Munster one, he says, and both take in five or six players each year. Leinster don't take hundreds into their academy each year, and the kids aren't geo-blocked. But as far as you understand, they actually are. And I would say also that the Leinster school system, broadly speaking, it's deeper, it's stronger, it's better funded than Munster across the board. And there's great examples of Munster schools doing a great job. You look at PBC and CBC and Glenstall, certainly much improved and improving programs. And we had a chat with Ger Burke and Andy Skeen around that, and they felt the level between Munster and Leinster, the top schools, was right there. But I think Leinster still is a bit ahead in terms of that funding and that resource. But an interesting email from Morgan there. I suppose the thing with Munster is you look at last weekend and you think, geez, that's a really good 23. You actually wouldn't want to play that 23 when everyone's available and fit. And that's the frustrating thing for me, reflecting on the Champions Cup campaign this year. Because you're right, internally, Munster do judge themselves at Champions Cup level. That's their barometer. Like, they want to be challenging and winning Champions Cup. Not to dismiss the URC at all. I thought it was an amazing journey and amazing victory. But they want to be competitive in Europe in Champions Cup, and it was just so frustrating that they did not get that 23 at all this season. Really, you look at the pool stages; they were crippled by injuries in the winter, obviously missing so many key guys for the Northampton game. And then you watch what they do in Pretoria last weekend. And I know there was a red card in, and we'll come to the specifics, but they had a really good first half to lead, and then they finished really strongly with an actual bench this time. It's been a big issue all season that they haven't had that punch and that impact. So, yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see how it goes next season. Obviously, more change on the way, but if they can get a little bit more luck, they can certainly, and get a little bit more luck on the injury front, they can certainly be more competitive than they have been. And we've acknowledged all the stuff they can do better in terms of their performance. Of course they can in the Champions Cup. But I thought last weekend was a really convincing reminder that this is, when they're all fit in harness, a really good team.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I mean, once you saw the team named, you kind of knew this was going to be a very tricky game for the Bulls. But probably it's absolutely, they got riddled with injuries this year, and it was a freak year. But realistically, when I look at that squad, Murray, and I look at next year's squad in particular, that's why I said it's a bit of a mess, because Frisch will be gone. Munster, like, this is people. So, there's a game being played here, and it's around negotiating a transfer fee, right?
So it was Mike Prendergast last week.
Look, it's like if there was, it should be one of the modules in coaching school is actually how you handle this. And absolutely, Mike has to and Munster have to try and get as much as possible. But the reality is, I would be absolutely shocked if Frisch, and being speaking to people in France, they're assuming he'll be gone. He'll probably get capped for France this summer. That's not Munster's fault, but it's a mess when it happens, right? It's disasters. And they've got a brilliant player, and he's probably going to be gone, right? Zeebo, we're led to believe, will be gone, okay? Snyman is definitely gone. We're led to believe Kilcoyne will be gone. Carberry's gone. I know they've signed Billy Burns, but Carberry, at his best, is better than Billy Burns, I would say. Obviously, you could argue otherwise, but that's my opinion. And Connor and Peace are, you know, probably their last year or two of their contracts. So what I'm saying is, you kind of, okay, you could cross your fingers and hope you have less injuries than they had, which was obviously pretty extreme. But realistically, for me, in terms of a European winning squad, it looks a bit threadbare. When you look at next year's squad at the moment, right? Now, maybe there's, obviously, they've got Kilgannon coming in, which is positive. But when you take into account over the last couple of years, they've lost Earls and Conway as well. They're two big players for them. Klein, you know, there's lots of talk about his injury being more serious maybe than, or being more serious. We haven't been told anything bad about it, but being a serious enough injury. So that's what I'm saying is, I actually think this year's squad, the squad that played against the Bulls, can go toe-to-toe with most teams in Europe. But unfortunately, rugby would tell you that there's going to be attrition and you need backup. And I think that's where they look light. And that's what I want Munster to get more funding to give Roundtree and Prendergast the chance to not just win a URC, to go toe-to-toe with the La Rochelles, the Toulouses, etc. And I know it's not simple because the game is in short, the money's in short supply, but I would actually argue that it's a great time to go to the market now, because you get really good players for a good price, and that's what Irish rugby should be looking to do. And the schools question, you're right. Generally, Leinster have a year and a half or a year to make a decision about those kids when they come out of school, and it has been quite protected. And the reality is, people say, "Oh, population, right?" So do we just say population favours Leinster? The rest need to go home. No, we need to look at that population and work out how we can be creative in terms of trying to spread that talent a little bit more evenly, if that's where most of the talent is, if that's where the ones that can actually go and get you central contracts. And then obviously a Jack Crowley, like, I've no doubt Jack Crowley's going to get a central contract. That's great, you know what I mean? But we've known about Jack Crowley for the last three years anyway. Like, where's the next Jack Crowley? How can Munster get to the stage where they've got five or six central contracts again on merit? On merit, because I've no doubt Andy Farrell is picking players on merit, and that's how I feel about it. So it's a really good chance for Humphreys to look at this again and try and work out. But look, I know there's obvious benefits for Team Ireland having the cohesion of having one team feeding into it at the level Leinster do. But I think we just need to be careful that the other three are supported. And I know it's not easy, it's money. But I don't think it's just money. I think it's actually looking at the whole pathway and how we can maybe adapt that a little bit.
And it should be said, Munster have done already and are in the process of doing excellent work in that regard and have really changed the picture in my mind in that way. And you can see it in the senior squad now. You look at like the guys who have established themselves, I guess, as core players, first of all. Your Crowley, Nash, Casey, Coombs, Hodnett, Tom Ahern, Barron, Kendell, and all these guys in around their mid-20s who are now key squad members. And then you look at the next wave, I suppose. Edwin Odogbo is a good example. Brian Gleeson's going to be a big player. Ruan Quinn, Ethan Cullen and Tony Butler coming from Ennis. There's a few more there that I'm probably forgetting. And apparently there's another layer to come underneath. The likes of Gino Leary, Kareem, and guys who are on the 18s, 19s now. I think there's a lot of excitement about that next layer. Of course, it's going to take a long time for that to convert into professional rugby and competing for Ireland spots, etc. But I think they're doing a really good job of that. And I think it's encouraging. And I don't think the solution is like, yes, you're so right about, you know, more everyone harnessing the breadth of player in the Leinster school system coming through there, and guys who maybe don't make their academy, but the solution has to be in-house for them, for Connacht, for Ulster, to a large degree, to the major degree, I think, is having that, your own pipeline is the predominant feeder. So I think the way Munster have shifted, and Groundtree seems to be a massive part of that, he seems to be totally focused on the homegrown players becoming the core, and what are they? They're nearly 2 years into it now, and I think you've seen the shift, the profile of that squad has changed. You've still got to have experience in there, and as you say, Birch, there's a bit of that leaving, but guys like Byrne, Haley, even Nankerville, I know he's not an old guy, but they're going to be the kind of, yeah, he's a great player and he's a calm head, and they're going to be key to continuing this rebuild as it is. Like, they had to rebuild. They weren't I just feel like the picture's changed a lot since 2 years ago, and the injuries, the unbelievably bad luck with injuries hasn't allowed us to see how that rebuild might have been. And a lot of the injuries were kind of freak. I went back through like the actual nature of a lot of the injuries this season. Not a lot of actual soft tissue stuff. Loads of like unlucky impact things that just are a bit freaky. Even Klein being out now, you know. So they need a bit more luck, as well as absolutely like closing that gap and making sure it doesn't open up anymore. But I think actually at the moment we're all falling into this trap of exaggerating the gap a little bit, I have to say. Munster are the current URC champs. I know it wasn't a perfect season, but they did win a trophy. Leinster haven't won a trophy since 2021. Of course, they look good at the moment, but they've looked good before and not won anything. And yeah, I don't... Maybe with Ulster there's a longer pathway back there, and that's probably the one that worries most. But I don't think Connacht are much different to where they've really been for the last long period. I don't think that's really changed all that much. So maybe I'll be singing a different tune in a couple of years, though. Maybe I'll be completely wrong.
Here's one from Brian Hughes. I'll throw it to yourself, Birch, to begin with. He says he listened to the pod on Friday. And may I ask why all the talk is about taking from Leinster to give to the other provinces on the last three odd podcasts now? The Leinster schools were in existence since the 1800s. Why the sudden beef? I heard nothing in early 2000s when Munster provided 7 Irish forwards and 2 halfbacks. When will you discuss the management of Leinster from Mick Dawson, a podcast or two in itself, or the mismanagement of other provinces who can't fill their stadium and need to refinance debt? How about the province who created a €1 million hole by not moving the La Rochelle match in time? All well and good taking from Leinster, but golden goose and all that. I lived in the 90s. I know what not being good is like. Mediocre could be as bad. Ask the Scots. I get and kind of agree with the chat around the central contract contribution, creating a sort of barter account. But can we discuss a system where mismanagement is not rewarded, leading to waste, as I don't feel Leinster have missed a trick in a long time in this regard?
I'm disappointed it's come across that way, that we haven't given credit where it's due, because I can specifically remember doing that in several instances. Leinster, I mean, Bert's already said it again, like, they've done a really good job of this. Even with the school system, they do a brilliant job. That's just talent. That's not actually a guarantee of a player being a good professional player. You've got to convert and guide that to top-end ability, and it's something that Leinster do really well. They invest in excellent coaching, even at the senior team. Like you're seeing it happen now. I know you made that point, Birch, with Blaendahl coming in, a guy who's really highly rated, and they seem to just get smart pickups in that regard. And I know within the system, they're excellent at doing that. So yes, players are coming out of school well-prepared from the program in that school, but when they get into 18 squads and into the sub-academy and into the academy, they're guided brilliantly. I agree on the job that Mick Dawson has done, and they're brilliant at doing that off the pitch in terms of getting a really strong core of ticket season holders. And like, there's other places with strong population bases that don't actually harness that well at all. There's rugby clubs in big cities all over the world who actually aren't as well run as Leinster, and they're brilliant at generating big revenue from their big home games that they work really hard to earn, and they put a big focus on being top seeds as much as possible. And I know they're obviously going to be in a battle now for that, but they always have a plan. I think they're excellent at drawing in investment from private sources where and when they've needed it as well, for things like building the training base in UCD. And yeah, they've been smoothly run. And amid all the kind of calls for the RFU to, you know, help out the provinces a bit more, that's certainly a sentiment that is in the union, I think, is that, listen, we have helped you a lot. We've helped you here, there. We've given you this player. We've moved him over to your province. We've encouraged this, and we've supported this kind of financial element of it. But, you know, has the return been what we would have liked? So there is definitely that feeling within the union, I think. And yeah, I'm disappointed to hear that it hasn't come across that we're giving credit to Leinster where it's due.
To be fair, yeah, I kind of pulled Brian up on that at the time in the WhatsApp group where he sent the message, and he did say, no, you guys have been fair to Leinster, but it was more the conversation around taking from Leinster in order to bring the other provinces up. I guess the crux of Brian's point, Birch, is that either in recent history or presently, the other three provinces have not been as well-run organizations as Leinster has been. Like that is actually, I would say, factual as well. And I'd include Munster in that, as much as they've probably turned a corner in the last couple of years and things are definitely looking up infrastructurally, academy, etc. Like, the other three provinces have been pretty poorly run compared to Leinster, and Brian doesn't like the idea of having to detract from Leinster in order to reward administrative incompetence over the last few years.
Yeah, no, I would agree with him, but the problem is I don't want to be looking back. I think I said it a couple times in this pod that, look, in the marketplace, Munster were known as a soft touch in terms of contract renegotiations. You know, to such an extent that when I said it on the pod, agents were texting me saying, shut up. But you know what I mean? Like, so, and in fairness, there's like, and the market, I think they're trying to sort that out. They're trying to, and maybe now they're going to have to be quite stingy, and maybe contracts are going to take a little bit longer to get sorted while they try and get back to market value. But yeah, there's no doubt that particularly Ulster and Munster, in fairness, I agree with Murray, Connacht haven't really changed anywhere. They're kind of treading along in the same spot, but said, I'd love to see a real positive plan there, and the Dexcom Stadium and the stadium build is a real positive sign. You know, I still think they need a bit more playing power, but budget is obviously making it hard to get that. But I would say, if you look at what frustrates me a little bit is that we haven't worked out what the right model is for each province, okay, in terms of recruitment, retention, coaching, longevity. So like, what I suppose what Cozzy's gone into in Munster, in Costello, I mean, that operation type role, like, that makes sense. You know what I mean? That after Graham Rowntree, you know, there's whoever comes in next is following a plan that's tailor-made, bespoke for Munster. And I think it's great that that's happened now. But, like, how long, like, what have we lost in the meantime before that was, that role was created? You know, the guy used to be role. I mean, okay, you could argue that it's because they have better financial resources. But I would say, if you're the RFU, surely having one expert in each province whose sole job is to get that recruitment right. You know, and like, Cozzy's role is probably a mixture, which is fine. But again, why hasn't that been, you know, funded or insisted upon to get the IRFU money, to get central contracting, to get, you know, this is what we think it looks like. Because if not, you're going to change and go through cycles of just change and no long term thought process. Like I remember a story, Alex Ferguson, you know, he was under pressure in Man United, and his head scout said to him, "Look, I'm struggling to get players. I'm struggling to attract talent in, because United are crap, whatever, right? And they're probably back crap again." But and basically he said, "What are you doing today?" He said, "I'm going down to London to try and sign a player." And he said, "Is he good?" "Yeah, he's the best right foot in English football. Would it help if I went with you?" "Yeah, it would help." And he basically got the train to London on his day off, spent 3 hours with David Beckham and his mum and dad in his living room, and convinced him to come to Man United as a 13-year-old, right? So that, you're lucky. You have a manager there who basically sees the big picture. But imagine having someone in each province who does, you know? And I think that's why Leinster still made mistakes, like recruitment-wise, but they made less mistakes probably than others. And like the Nina Barr, you know, was an unbelievable recruit. Tyler Blindale, it seems like, is going to be a really positive recruit for Leinster Rugby. But Leinster have someone there who's not worried about the day-to-day, you know, things happening. His job is to get recruitment retention done. So that's what I think we could do better. Like, I think it's starting to fall into place, you would think. Ulster obviously have to get a new CEO. You know, Brent Cunningham would probably become the DOR, get a new coach if it's not Richie Murphy, and start a new cycle. Whereas, wouldn't it be great if there was a little bit more consistency, which was supported by the IRFU, and it was all done in an aligned way? Like, we're 30 years into professional rugby now. Like, we are an island. Like, we haven't been as distracted as everybody else. And yes, there's still loads of things we can do, which is great.
Yeah. And the fact that we are 30 years into professionalism is what I'd say to Brian's point about the Leinster schools and how they've been around since the 1800s. And why weren't we hearing about it then or along the way? And why weren't we hearing about it in the 2000s when Munster had 7 forwards in the Irish pack? It's because the further into professionalism you go, the more pertinent, the more important finance actually becomes. Like, you have the Leinster schools who are now in a place financially where they have access to a wealth of professional elite resources, infrastructure, and that's how you really funnel through like professional talent ultimately. And there are just more schools in Leinster that can do that than there are in Munster or in Ulster or in Connacht. That's kind of where the difference is now, where it may not have existed in days gone by.
Before we wrap this up, let me just flag one other email from Paul Gill. It's got a Connacht slant on it, and it's good news. He's a happy man because he says, "I thought you might be interested in seeing that Connacht could actually field an Indigenous 15 if you allow that Joe Joyce's parents came from the heart of Connemara and he spent a couple of childhood summers there." He says, "With a couple of positional switches, here's the Connacht team, all homegrown. Dennis Buckley, Onda Butler or Dylan Tierney-Martin. Matthew Burke switching from loose head to tight head. You have Joe Joyce, Dara Murray, Niall Murray, Oisin McCormick, Dave Heffernan at number 8, actually, which would work. He's a former back row. Caelan Blade, Jack Carty, Matthew Devine on the wing, which definitely would work given his performance at the weekend. Kyle Ford, Hugh Gavin, Shane Jennings and Tiernan O'Halloran," which actually, it's a pretty spicy team. I know there's a couple of guys out of position, but he says it's a nice blend of youth and experience. Credit must be given to Connacht, as we would have struggled to field 5 players, homegrown players, not long ago. Keep up the great work. So thanks for that bit of sunshine on a Monday morning, Paul.
Yeah, nice one, Paul. I was actually literally about to swing back around and say maybe it would have been harsh, or maybe it was harsh that I lumped Connacht in as being like badly run. As you guys say, they're kind of in a similar spot to where they have been, and that is evidence, obviously, from Paul of a lot of the good work they're doing on the ground there. Suppose when you talk about the provinces in any capacity, you're going to piss off at least a portion of their fan base, particularly some of the online crew perch.
Well, it's like, this is like, again, I was heartened by the Croke Park selling out. I'm just thinking, like, imagine the national stadium for Ireland matches was that big on a regular basis. Like, it would sell out. It's kind of eye opening to me. I'm thinking, wow, they actually, given the current grow for rugby and attention towards it, it's massive at the moment. But, and also all the strong opinion and the sheer quantity of opinion on this subject, I don't know what it's hard to define exactly what we're talking about, really, just the system. It's great to see, though. It's people really care and people have really considered opinions and strong forthright opinions on it. And it's not just about the Irish team, it's about the province. And it's a reminder that that's so important to so many people. Like, loving your province was many people's way into the game. We spoke at the AIL, others came through that avenue and their club and up the pathway that way. But there's a real like interest and large scale debate on this whole subject. So I think it's brilliant to see. And yeah, well, people definitely disagree with each other. On the whole, it's quite civil, and that's brilliant. When it spills over, as it does at times, especially online, and gets nasty, that's obviously horrible. But it's cool for people to disagree, and I think it's a good thing for people to have that difference of opinion at times and have their ears open to others.
Munster fans certainly gave, or Munster players, excuse me, certainly gave their fans a stick with which to beat you, Birch, when they went down to Pretoria and became the first European team to beat the Bulls on the Highveld at Loftus-Versfeld. We've obviously touched upon how it was an impressive victory, but what actually stood out to you covering the game, Birch? Like, how did Munster pull this off to begin with?
Very good balance in their game. I thought Crowley controlled it incredibly well. You could see they were trying to build a scoreboard, like that early shot from Conor Murray from 60 metres. You know, they just wanted to get ahead of the Bulls. I thought their selection, like, and again, it's down to having the personnel, but having a strong bench to come on and, you know, impact players coming off the bench. Having Snyman available to start, I thought he had some big moments. I mean, he can do things with the ball, without the ball that others can't. It was just, some of their tack was really sharp. Obviously they dropped a few balls, but like the Bulls just couldn't handle Munster when Munster played their phase attack game. They just looked at sixes and sevens, and they're getting good gain lines. Breakdown was pretty ruthless because Bulls are physical, and I thought it was the best performance they've put in a while. Like, compared to the Cardiff match at home a couple of weeks ago, you know, it was chalk and cheese, and I think. It looks like they're geared up for a big finish to the season, and that's obviously that's a big win for them. That's a big win, and they'll get massive belief from that. But I thought all around in defence and attack, they showed some really, really good signs, and particularly when the red card happened, you know, Crowley with the crossfield kicks, just again exploiting that space on the edges. The Bulls naturally are quite narrow in defence because the wings tend to come in, but Crowley, you know, just executed two really good crossfield kicks, which again, you know, well, he scored off one and obviously got him on the front foot again, and just being able to avoid that physicality that the Bulls bring by either really good ball movement, good lines of running, but then obviously said that kick pass option as well. So, no, all in all, I think they'd be absolutely delighted.
What stood out to you, Mer, about how Munster went about this victory?
The accuracy of the final 20 minutes or just post the red card really stood out to me, but also how they built a lead in the first half. And as I said, that kind of gets overlooked maybe a little bit when the red card happens, which is a bit of a stroke of luck, but geez, they were due one, weren't they? It helped them get over the line, but I thought there was so many good elements in this performance. I thought Crowley was just unbelievable, really. He had a bad day against Northampton where he made mistakes that were at this stage uncharacteristic of him, but you know, he's going to the Highveld. He puts so much pressure on himself. We know that. He's got high expectations of himself, and he goes to the Highveld and just bosses the game. I thought his kick right before halftime was really important. 45 metre on the angle, gets in at 17-10, really important moment. But also the touches on the ball. Birch has mentioned the kicking there, but he's up there as the best at that subtle, slight delay of the ball to put people into space, either on his inside or outside. He's got such an acute understanding of the space around him, how much of it there is left, and how much the defender is likely to advance or close on him or otherwise, and how to either slip the ball straight away or just wait. Sometimes he's standing still to do it, and he lets them bring their line speed and he slips someone away. Other times he does have those little darts at the line. And I'd say a lot of it is very instinctive on his part. You know, in that split second, you're not overthinking things or running through it in your mind. It happens instinctively. But a lot of guys don't have that appreciation of space and understanding of where the defenders and his teammates indeed are going to be. He's just brilliant at it. And in the lead up to Snyman's try, you saw a couple of touches in that regard in particular to get them into position. And they closed it out really well to to get in front, but also to hold on. Obviously, the Jack, I mean, it's always a great Munster day when you see lads just winning beautiful Jackal penalties. Nankivell took some serious punishment at one stage. Byrne gets one, Ahern gets one, Coombs gets one, and the bench did make a massive impact. And that just made me think, it's a pity we didn't get to see this 23 on one of the bigger European days with that bench punch to come. I thought it was class to see them win a scrum penalty before they go and score the Conor Murray try. Like, against the Bulls in South Africa, that's not what you're expecting. But Witcherly, Clark and Jaeger, it was on Jaeger's side, they came up with a massive penalty there after the Bulls, uncharacteristically themselves, try and force the ball out, and they going down the short side, and I think it's Jack O'Donoghue who manages the number eight really well and gets a forward pass. Even like, yeah, it was a really complete performance from Munster, and though it was level, though they went behind, it was, even before the red card, it felt like there's a bit of composure here and a bit of belief based on having all those guys and having that bench to call on. The altitude and heat didn't even seem to be really a factor at all. And yeah, I thought it was a really good day for them. And I thought there was real shades of last season, the tail end of last season, I felt, just looking at it, you think, this looks a bit familiar. And if they can have a bit of luck now and keep these guys fit, and Orji Snyman is throwing these delightful touches of the ball, you're not going to want to play this team. And even on the road, they don't seem to struggle with that. In fact, they're actually probably better on the road these days than with the pressure at Thomond Park on them. So I think it was exciting, and it was what they needed after the despondency post Northampton. So yeah, it's going to be hard to grasp that URC trophy off them.
Shades of 2018 as well, Birch, about Conor Murray's performance, no?
Yeah, it was brilliant to see him. Obviously, end up playing nearly the full game with Craig Casey, obviously having that headbang and not come back on. And yeah, it was great to see him bounce back, and he had an instrumental role. Obviously, he scored a try, but I just thought his control, his box kicking, everything about him was back at a level we haven't seen for a while. So he'd have loved that. I mean, he's become a bit of a bit part player, obviously closing out games for Ireland. But he just showed, you know, his contract renewal was merited, and it'd be really interesting, the battle between himself and Casey now over the rest of the season.
Murray looked a bit pissed off, and I think he plays really good rugby when he's like that. We spoke to him in Limerick at the HPC a few weeks ago at this stage, and he was going through the bile and the abuse that he got after Twickenham, and he did seem pissed off about it, really pissed off. And even with the contract, people question that. He's well aware of what people say and all the criticism that he gets. And I thought there was an edge to him, even like he wasn't letting decisions go that he felt were against Munster. And there were a couple of them where the Jackal is just like on the ball for so long. It really seems to frustrate him when they don't get those. When the Jackal is on the ball for seconds at a time and gets coached off it, but the quick ball is gone and the opportunity is gone. But yeah, I thought he looked more aggressive that way. I'm not sure exactly how to define it. Pissed off probably the best way. Made the most tackles of any of the backs and just got stuck in. And even the way he took his try, it was just a moment where he said, I'm going to grab this opportunity and take it. So yeah, fired up Conor Murray, I think, is really good again when you're heading into the kind of run-in of the season.
You mentioned the red card being a stroke of luck for Munster, and Birch, Ulster needed a stroke of luck from somewhere. I suppose the only counter argument to that is that Cardiff also needed that stroke of luck and didn't get it towards the end of that game. The Rhys carry not gone, or lack thereof, what were your thoughts on it?
God, I thought it was very marginal. To be honest, actually, it's marginal whether he touched it, and if he did touch it, I think he went backwards in the end. So, huge call. I mean, the Welsh Rugby Union even called it out. Well, look at it again, things are changing in the game. So you have the Welsh Rugby Union basically pretty much criticising the referee, and then, I don't know, did you see Notts Forest yesterday come out and had a tweet as well? So, that's not ideal. But look,
just to clarify for people who didn't see that, Birch, the Welsh Rugby Union calling it out, it was their match report basically
match report,
on the
sorry,
WRU.
The match report, website, sorry. Yeah. Sorry, the match report on the website basically. Question the officiating. To be honest, I thought it was a very, very, very lucky break for Ulster. Even if you think it's knocked on, calling that a deliberate knock on and giving a penalty is extreme. It looked like there was a knock on from Cooney earlier for a try, which they didn't look at. Certainly was as obvious to a certain extent as the Carey one. Yeah, Ulster just fluked their way through it, didn't they? Like it's one of those matches when you look at the officiating and you say this is the biggest weakness for the URC. And I don't want to get into referee banging here, but it certainly wasn't a great performance, I would say, for Mike Adamson. Which would, if you're a Welsh fan and look at their, you could say that they're skeptical anyway, but it would lead you to believe that it was a hometown decision. And yeah, but looking from an Ulster point of view, it's a win. But like, they're not firing at all, are they? I mean, they look poor. And I just hope they turn around from an Ulster point of view over the next couple of weeks, because they're not going to be anywhere. Like they're going to struggle to make top eight if they don't. I know they got a win, but they actually dropped down a couple of places. They're going to need to find a lot more than that. And fair, look at Cardiff, obviously, we have to give them credit. They are a very sticky team. Well, they've got a huge amount of losing bonus points this year. Just struggling to get that win that they deserve, to be fair. You know. And in fairness, Ospreys and Cardiff, given all everything that's gone wrong in Welsh rugby, given their limited budgets, are doing very well. Cardiff less so, but Ospreys obviously haven't beaten the Stormers. Like they are credit to Matt Sherratt and Toby Booth for what they managed to get out of their team this season.
Murray, your thoughts on the Ulster endgame, the incident involving Carey, whether it was clear or obvious to you?
I thought they got a bang on. I'm utterly convinced that he knocked it on, utterly. And I think his motion is a slapping motion. I don't think he's ever going to catch that. It's instinctive, but I'm absolutely convinced he knocks the ball on before it touches the Ulster player. And I had a look at it again this morning to make sure. I'm very clear in my mind. The bit I thought they got lucky on is a Chukwu try-saver, which, first of all, is an incredible bit of athleticism from him, a guy who I've kind of been waiting for him to kick on or get a chance. He covers some ground. He slaps down the fend really well on Thomas Young, but then he uses his foot. And for me, he kicks the ball away. I mean, I don't know if he's deliberately trying. I don't think he's thinking, I'm going to kick this out of his hands. I think he may be trying to get his foot underneath it just to in any way prevent it being grounded. But I think he stops a try with the use of the foot. And for me, that was a penalty try. They didn't seem to even discuss it, which surprised me. Maybe they did. Maybe I didn't hear it on my broadcast of the game, but I thought that was a penalty try, to be honest. So I think Ulster got the stroke of fortune there. But on the Carey one, I thought it was absolutely spot on from them. But
are you saying, Murray, you see it being knocked on? You see it with your own two eyes?
Yes. I'll share the clip with you both after. I slowed it down. You have to slow it down quite a bit, but I'm the TMO obviously did that.
Well, I'm comfortable saying it now, but I actually agree with you.
You agree?
I agree with you.
You have to slow down. And I mean, we're getting into like really small details and really slow down. But I suppose if you have the technology, why not use it to do that? So I think there should be more controversy really over the Zuchuk one, which was pretty clear in my mind. And listen, the joy of rugby is you can read the law, interpret the law however you want. Maybe he didn't kick it out, but I thought he used the foot to prevent what was otherwise a definite try there. And yet he puts himself in an amazing position to do it. And yeah, if you work a bit harder, you tend to get a bit luckier. But they, for me, got away with it in that regard. And I agree, the performance again was like, it doesn't feel like they've had this bounce after the change. I'm seeing guys just aren't playing great rugby or just making a lot of basic mistakes. And maybe that's coming because they're trying too hard almost, or they've made changes and they're not quite nailing down the detail of that. I'm not sure. It's impossible to say from the outside, but a lot of the performance was pretty poor, to be honest. And yeah, I don't think Ulster fans are coming away from it really enthused that they're going to have a massive, powerful, strong finish to the season. They don't seem to have got that big bounce out of making a big, drastic change with only a couple of months of the season left.
The Zuchuku incident is interesting, Birch, because if anyone has played the game at an amateur level and was a poor tackler like I was, technically, it's the kind of technique you use if you're trying to tackle somebody from behind but you're not confident you can actually take them down. So you kind of sweep the leg as you do it. And you tripped him. It looks like you make it look like this organic fluid movement, like it wasn't intentional, but you were literally tripping them up. And I actually do think he knew what he was doing in kind of swinging his legs around. And I think it probably should have been a penalty try I guess it just adds to the sense of grievance on Cardiff's behalf. But I'm just wondering, before we move on from it, did you have any different interpretation of that one?
No, I thought it should have been looked at. I sounds terrible, but I'd say they didn't even know the rule, or just decided that the ball wasn't kicked out. I don't know how they didn't go through that in detail. I mean, that's the obvious thing that I thought when I saw it replay. I said, great defensive effort, but surely that's being kicked out of his hand. But look, I said, I don't. Nothing surprises me at the moment. I genuinely, nothing surprises me about officiating. No. I think it's been left behind. It's getting, and coaches now are kind of going, look, we'll do what we do, but we know we could lose a game over a mistake. Yeah.
There weren't too many mistakes in Connacht's destruction of Zebre in the end. It was a perfect way to bounce back, I guess. Murr, 8 tries to 2 in a must-win game. And I guess, they're still very much in the mix.
Yeah, it was great. It was really great. And it allows them to go into that Dragons match next weekend, which is really important, with a bit of confidence, nice weather. That's a good day out in Galway for the Connacht fans. And they kind of deserved it, especially the ones who've been on the road and travelling to support them in the Challenge Cup. Like, they're the... I know it's not the most epic contest, but by all means of rugby, but they're the ones where you'd like, I'd love to be in Galway on that day, watch the game, out into Galway for a few pints. It's a wonderful place when it's like that. And the players were clearly loving it. There was great energy. I did think Matthew Devine added so much to that. And he's the one who gets them going. And like, again, he's definitely a player who we watch in the 20s and think, this guy is going to be really brilliant when he gets into the senior team. And of course, it can take a while to get there, being physically resilient and all that kind of stuff, but he looks ready to go now. He's so alert and his acceleration is so rapid that he can just take any sniffing of an opportunity around the breakdown, and he looks confident. I think he's got that edge about him. He kind of plays big and seems to have that big expectation as well, and when you've got the likes of him coming through, and then Hugh Gavin's going to be following in the next couple of years as well, I think that's brilliant to see. That doesn't make you a trophy contending team, but it gives... First of all, it gives the fans a massive connection to the team, because it's players of their own kind of making and producing. But also, it does make you a better team when you've got guys they look like they could be really top players. That's brilliant to see. But on the whole, a very sharp attacking performance. I thought JJ Hanrahan did a really good job of steering so much of that. And he definitely got in on the fun. It was a really positive day for Connacht, and tease him up nicely, as I said, now to try and go to Dragons and try and get maximum points from that, because it could be key.
Caelan Blade had made a really fast start to the season, Birch, at scrum half, and probably hasn't had the best month or two in terms of his own personal form. And Devine looks like he could be that spark plug. As Murray says, he energises the fans as well as the players around him. And I wouldn't say like Connacht needed an injection of something at this stage of the season. They obviously went to Poe a couple of weeks ago and won. But when you have a player like him and you can bring him in and it kind of offers a fresh impetus, it bodes well for the last few regular season games and hopefully a playoff run.
Yeah, look, Blade has been excellent for Connacht. I think probably he's they've had to overplay him, you know, and he's looked like he's overplayed. And Devine has come in fresh. I played with his father, Mick Devine. He was a winger who wasn't unbelievably quick, big, didn't have a great sidestep, but actually was a nightmare to play against, and great fellow to play with. And I think his sons are kind of similar. They're just tough, in your face, want to have a go, never back down, terrier like. I'm not saying that they don't have more athleticism, but it's great to see that. It's great to see that, and he was brilliant. And the crowd will just respond to local fellas, young fellas. And when Gavin comes in, it'll be the same. His dad was an unbelievable servant to Goeagues and Connacht, and it's great to see that generation coming through, talented generation playing in their under 20s and now going into the senior team. I think Devine could give them a spark, if not starting, but give him Blade, you know, less 80 minutes, and they'll get, like, there's a real good feel good factor down there. Obviously Finney Beatham's 200 game, and they've got obviously that was an easy game on paper. I know Zebre have improved, but that was a 5-pointer on paper. They got that, and Dragons this week, you would say, is a 5-pointer as well. If Connacht are really on their money, Dragons still conceding a lot of points, so yeah, 10 points in 2 weeks, and then obviously they finish in Dublin against Leinster, but it's a week after the European Cup final, I think, if Leinster are there.
And they've Stormers at home as well.
Yeah, so Stormers at home. So who knows? Like, the fixtures probably aren't as bad as some of the other teams are competing with for that top eight. So could be a nice end of season to them.
Yeah, the only reason I bring up the Stormers game is that it probably doesn't feel as daunting on paper as it did even a couple of weeks ago, right? That looks like an opportunity for Connacht now. And if you're coming in off the back of 2 5-pointers, as you say, hey, it could be a fun finish to the season. Meanwhile, Birch, the wheels have come off at Leinster. If ever there was a province that was a mess, it's a team that goes down to Johannesburg.
That's what I've been told, yeah, Jesus. I didn't realise that their second or third team weren't allowed to lose. But look, it was a very poor performance. I mean, look, Leo won't be worried. It's not as he was just disappointed because a lot of those players have been able to get wins, to be fair, when the main players have been rested or are off. And they were blown away. Obviously, went, 22-0 down. The stats were just, if you look at the stats for that game, you wonder how the Lions won, never mind, won easily. They had something like 30% possession. Leinster had nearly triple the amount of passes, etc. But just their attack just couldn't really put the Lions away. Even before half time, like the amount of time they spent in the Lions 22 and just couldn't get that last pass, couldn't clean that ruck out quick enough.
The Lions defended well as well.
No, the Lions are better side. Obviously, they came and hammered Connacht. Things are starting to fall into play for them, and they deserve massive credit. They were ruthless. Some of their attack to get that early start was very good, and defended well. But Leinster, I don't know what it was, but they were crap last year against the Bulls in the second match. If you remember they won, beat the Lions last minute in the first game, and then got smashed up in Pretoria. And I suppose Leo will be hoping it's the opposite this week, that they find a bit more. But I wouldn't be too worried about it really. But it's not
just
it's
with an eye to the Stormers game, Birch. Like, I'm sure they would have gone down there with 2 23s in mind, one for Johannesburg, one for Cape Town. Would that plan change at all based on what's happened against the Lions and based on the fact that Leinster won a home run and like arguably home the whole way? Do they deviate from the plan that they came down with based on what happened there?
No, I don't think they won't. I think they'll give whatever fellas who didn't play well a second chance. I think they have to, because realistically for that group, like, when are they going to play again this season? You know, what opportunities are they going to get in the next 6-7 weeks if they don't get another chance now to show what they can do? So I don't think you'll change massively. But they'll be looking for a big bounce back. You know what I mean? Like, we laud that depth all the time, and we talk about that talent that's underneath the main players. Certainly, that wasn't obvious collectively at the weekend.
Murray, the Lions obviously have improved, and I just wanted to flag their defense, because like we associate them with being like this brilliant transition team, a brilliant attacking team in general now. And when you look at the stats, and even just sort of based on an eye test watching the game, it was just like really positive defensive interventions that you kind of wouldn't necessarily associate with the Lions. From the attacking point of view, from Leinster's standpoint, though, like going down to a Stormers team that actually needs a result now as well, like they're, you know, they're probably being edged out of the race for home playoffs. Like, is it just about execution for Leinster this time around? Like, where would you see them having to improve if they're going to completely reverse their fortunes in the space of a week?
It absolutely is getting over the line themselves when they get in. They had 14 possessions in the Lions 22 and only get the 2 tries, which is incredibly poor return for Leinster, who are generally quite clinical. So they did lots of stuff to get into the right positions, and then on the other side of the ball they did concede. The Lions attack is lethal, of course it is. They scored some class tries and they deserve all their credit, but you're conceding 44 points still. That's not a good enough standard for a Leinster team with Winnie Naber in charge. And like, I look at the team sheet even now and I don't, like, it's a strong Leinster team. It's a, like, there's international players in there. There's an All Black in there. There's a guy capped by the Springboks. There's some top young talent in there, guys who've played for Ireland. And I don't think that performance will be in any way acceptable to them. It's rare enough that it happens with Leinster, and maybe it's sometimes a good thing to have that, and people can learn from, you learn from the pain probably more than the satisfaction of beating a team. But yeah, I think I think it'll be handy for Leo in that way to use it as a stick to beat players with in a different way. And I think people will have learned pretty harsh lessons. They seem to be out on their feet after like 30 seconds. They're under their own post and they all seem to be absolutely gassed. And I know they're up at altitude, but quite a few of them had been there before. And it just took so long to get... They were just very flat for the first 20 minutes. And now you've got a mountain to climb, but you still put yourself in more than enough position. You've got 75% of the territory and over 60% of the possession and all those visits to the 22. But the malaise just seem to be apparent in basic drop balls, poor decisions, or, you know, going for the line at the wrong time and being a little bit too hasty on a couple of occasions. So it was a very bad Leinster performance while we're giving the Lions their dues. And they're kind of lucky that Munster did them a favour with the Bulls, I think, and Glasgow, I know, are just a point behind, but could be a tighter race than usual. Sometimes they're kind of out of sight coming towards the end of the regular season, but there's definitely still work to do. And probably a wake up for a couple of guys who would have hoped that this was actually a springboard maybe to featuring even in a knockout game with the kind of frontline 23, but that wasn't the case at all. I don't think anyone at all came out of it with major credit.
One of the funniest things about the Lions, Birch, is that their points difference is plus 109 and they're 11th in the table. I think it's the third or fourth best points difference in the entire competition. But like, as we know, it's unbelievably condensed. So I think I'm just looking at the table now, sorry. They're only 3 points behind Benetton in fifth. So like, they're right in this playoff race in their own right. And just like, because you brought up the fact that the Ospreys had beaten the Stormers away, it's actually, I know we... Sometimes maybe it can seem a little bit mawkish if we're bigging up the ORC too much, particularly if you're listening from outside of that equation. But this season in particular, it's such an exciting race. Like, just in terms of the entertainment across the board, games like Stormers Ospreys that you might not have necessarily been inclined to watch in the past, they're worth watching this time around because of all of the playoff implications involved in them.
Yeah, it's exactly what the URC want. And to be honest, it's probably we would have felt... when the South Africans came in, it was going to be, you know, three or four of the Irish provinces, three of the South African provinces, with the Lions kind of being a little left behind, and then one of the Scots and maybe Treviso. But, you know, that's not the case at all. It's much more competitive. There is a race to make that top eight. There's a race to get home advantage, and it's exactly what the league needs. Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I think the only issue they have is the main issue is officiating, but everything else is actually is moving quite nicely.
To finish on the Women's Six Nations, you said last week, Birch, that Ireland needed to almost discount what would happen at Twickenham. It was always going to be, or always likely to be, a heavy defeat, and it was about building towards Scotland. Don't lose the momentum from the victory over Wales. I don't know if that's possible now, to be honest.
No, it was way worse. It was way worse, Gav, than I expected, to be fair. I thought a similar defeat that we had against France, or maybe a little bit, France haven't been as good, maybe just a little bit more, but we were blown away. It actually could have been 100. It could have easily been 100 points. So I acknowledge the fact that they're a lot further along than us, but I think that was pretty... a pretty stark, I suppose, reminder of the reality of the Gulf. But it is still important that they don't let it affect their chances of obviously beating Scotland, which is obviously more achievable. But that was a dark day, I think, for Irish women's rugby.
Yeah, 14 tries they conceded, Murray. And I guess some of it you can tolerate because England are the best team in the world, arguably. A lot of the tries, though, it's hard. I find it hard to be too harsh when, like, you're conceding your 9th, 10th, 11th tries and some of the women are slipping off tackles, because it's like, Jesus, the train has left the station at that point. Like, I think it's tough to properly buy into it and put your body on the line at that point, but I guess it didn't make for a good picture in the end. To what extent do you think it would be possible for them to just park that dark day, as Birch says, move on to brighter days again? There's a huge amount on the line in this Scotland game. Like, can you make that distinction or that kind of abrupt stop in your head and just get back to the wheel?
Well, you're going to going back almost to a different competition, aren't you? A completely different tier of the competition. You've stepped up to those lofty heights, and yeah, you're right, they probably just need to write off a lot of it, but there's professional players there who are going to be really hard on themselves, and their coaches, I'm sure, are going to be hard on them because they've bigger ambitions than that. But it was worrying to me because people, once they announced the contracts, there was this kind of wave of, it was greeted positively, which is great, obviously, but I think some people maybe saw it as, you know, this is going to quickly catch up the Irish. It was seen as a kind of cure-all, even though it wasn't even long-term part of RFU's strategy, and suddenly it just happens and people think they're going to catch up now. But the problem is, though Ireland are accelerating now, Irish women's rugby is accelerating, as we've said a few times, the England and a few other teams are accelerating even faster from an already far higher base. So, like, how are they going to close that gap? I genuinely, that's my worry for women's rugby, is like, how are they actually going to bring these other nations who now are investing belatedly in many instances and getting better, and they've got some really good programs, really good coaching in place, but how are they going to catch up with the teams who are already miles ahead and are now accelerating even faster because they've put that in long-term investment into it and because their players are at such a high level? So it feels like just completely, not even different tiers, but different stratospheres almost in the game, and that's not ideal. So I don't know, do you restructure the competition? I just feel like we're at a point in women's rugby where it has to go its own way and stop just like mimicking exactly what men's rugby has always done, which doesn't even work in men's rugby in some instances, everything that we've seen in the game for so long. There has to be more of a freshness and a creativity. Even the Lions thing, I think, again, which is exciting and all, but like, it doesn't make sense to me in a women's rugby context, if I'm being brutally honest, though I'm sure I'll tune in and enjoy it. So yeah, I do worry about that gap opening up even more. Like, England are going to get better in the next year again, and probably at an even faster rate than the rate which Ireland are improving. So I thought it was a dark day, of course, but it actually isn't that surprising to me, if I'm being brutally honest.
I think England will hockey France. Like, I think they are decidedly the best team in the world at the moment. I think they've already improved a lot in 12 months. Just before we go, what you're saying about not mimicking the men's game, as in, blow up the Six Nations, create something else, an actual distinct tournament involving Italy, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, maybe bring Spain in, things like that, or like just different competitions.
I don't have a concept in my head, and I'm sure I'll get probably a couple of emails from people who do, because usually we have a listener or two who has an idea, but I don't know. I just think it has never made sense to me that women's rugby does exactly everything the same way, or is trying to do exactly everything the same way. There's some things absolutely that could be replicated. I think a European Cup in club rugby would be cool to see and would improve the competitiveness there. But yeah, I just look at games like that and I think England are in a utterly different league to where Ireland are. And how helpful is it for an improving Ireland team and a developing young Irish team to have a day like that?
Not very. Murray, thanks a million as always.
Thanks, boys.
Birch, great to see you. Thank you.
Cheers, guys. Take easy.
Thanks, everyone at home as well, for all of your continued support. Back later in the week. Mind yourselves in the meantime. Thank you.
Put the boys in a better land. You're always talking about the boys in a better land. The boys in a better land. Try to stop names.